Well, as John Stewart called for civility in politics this past weekend, we couldn't help but remember that in 1859, a man on his way to vote was clobbered, knifed, and shot at. George Kyle, a Democrat, headed to the polls in Baltimore's 15th Ward in the election of 1859, his ballot tucked under his arm because, like all voting Americans, he had to bring his own ballot and hold on tight.
As he neared the polls, a ruffian tried to snatch his ballots. Kyle dodged and wheeled and heard a cry. His brother, just behind him, had been struck. Next, someone clobbered Kyle, who drew a knife but didn't have a chance to use it. "I felt a pistol put to my head," he said. Grazed by a bullet, he fell. When he rose, he drew his own pistol, hidden in his pocket. Someone else fired a shot, hitting Kyle in the arm. A man carrying a musket rushed at him. Another threw a brick, knocking him off his feet. George Kyle picked himself up and ran. He never did cast his vote. Nor did his brother, who died of his wounds.
His brother dies, Kyle's candidate loses, and despite appeals, his opponent's victory is upheld in Congress on the grounds that any man of ordinary courage could have made his way to the polls. Voting in early America was not for the faint of heart. Jill Lepore is professor of American history at Harvard University. She's the author most recently of The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. We'll have her on down the road with her take on the Tea Party after today's election. But today we want to reprise a conversation we had with her about voting in early America. I want to know more about George Kyle and why he was targeted.
Well, just because it was possible for people who are at the polls to tell how he was going to vote based, probably in this case, on the color of his ballots. Parties printed ballots and made them available to voters, and then you had to bring them to the polls, but you couldn't really hide how you were going to vote, because by this point in 1859, the time George Kyle is going to the polls, ballots are these huge, some of them are like 3 feet by 3 feet. You have to fold them up like a giant map, and they're printed in very bright colors just for this purpose, so that ruffians who are paid by the parties to work the ballots, they're called shoulder strikers, can sort of bully you away from reaching the polling place by identifying that you're voting for the other party.
Shoulder strikers, they had a name for them.
89 Americans are killed at the polls on Election Day riots in the decades before the Civil War.
Unbelievable. And when people would challenge it in Congress, members of Congress would say things like, you quote one representative saying, "Are you not a man in the full vigor of manhood and strength?" I mean, it was expected that you were going to exert some muscle to get to the polls.
It is a fairly manly endeavor, and that's actually part of it. Remember, women can't vote, for one thing.
Right.
Voting has a long history of being a kind of rowdy public holiday. And in the middle of the 19th century, it reaches a new kind of level of excess, where finally reform does come in. But that's also part of the wonderful thing about the exuberance of 19th century democracy. More people can vote than have ever been able to vote before. Yes, women can't vote, and in most places, black men can't vote. But all of a sudden, all white men can vote, and they turn up, in these great numbers. 80% of people show up in the polls.
Because previously, and when the country was founded, it was just men who owned land. Take us back to the beginning. And in the beginning, there were no ballots to steal because it was voice votes. In fact, you write, it was the stuff of corn and beans and hands and feet. Take us back to the beginning of voting in America.
Voting in early America follows voting in England, where many of the early colonists are coming from. But it is very restricted by property qualifications. And it is often the case that voting is done really literally with your body. Apparently, this still happens in town meetings in New England,
sure,
where you're asked to go from, you know, to one side of the room or the other.
Sure.
Also to raise your hand. That's a viva voce vote, raising your hand.
Viva voce.
Vote with your voice, uh-huh, to call out to say yay or nay. The way that votes are cast on the floor of legislative bodies is viva voce in most cases.
Well, and we saw some of this in caucuses, too, in the primaries, where people would have to go to one side of the room or the other or stand with the people they are for. And you also write that in some cases, people might toss a bullet into a hat or a little ball into a hat to vote.
Well, the word ballot comes from the Italian word ballotta, which means tiny ball. And when people talk about ballots in early America, they're not talking about pieces of paper. Very few people know how to read or write in early America. They're talking about corn and beans. They're talking about voting with bullets. They would paint bullets. You'd have like a bucket of bullets. Some would be painted red and some would be unpainted, or some would be painted white. You would just pick and toss them into a hat. It's important to remember, even when paper voting comes in, which is very slowly, they're not voting with paper to keep their votes secret. They're voting with paper just because it's easier. The idea that voting would be secret is a very recent idea in world history.
Yeah, because you write, the U.S. was founded on an experiment in 18th century republicanism in which it was understood that only men with property would vote, and they would vote publicly. Now, what was the importance of that?
if you think about how our legislators vote and how important it is that we know how they vote, you'll get the basic premise behind the idea that citizens' votes should be public. Their vote is representing our political will, and we need to know how their vote is cast. And that basic premise was understood to lie behind how everybody voted in early America. And that's actually partly because so few people voted, that they were, in fact, representing the rest of the electorate. Mm. So that if only property-owning white men can vote, they actually need to be voting with the interests of their wives and their children and their servants and their slaves and all the poor men who can't vote in mind. And their votes need to be knowable in that way. The two things are very closely related. The more suffrage expands, the more private people are willing to be about their voting, because then they're representing themselves and not representing other people.
Well, fast forward us, because you write the 18th century experiment in republicanism gradually gave way to the unruly exuberance of the 19th century democracy. Take us through. How did we start voting more with paper, with ballots?
First of all, the population expanded quite a lot and became easier and more convenient to be voting with paper. But it's actually all left to the states. The Constitution makes no provision for this. So states and even towns make their own decisions about how they'll vote. And so there's a great range. There's nothing kind of general you can say, except that very slowly people turn to the paper ballot.
Well, and also that it's not the way we think of balloting today. A lot of these were ballots that were printed in the newspaper and people cut out and brought with them to the polls, which brings us back to George Kyle in some way, you know, with his carrying his big ballot under his arm. These were called tickets. Tell us a little more about this.
First, people actually are just supposed to, it's called scrap voting. You just bring a scrap of paper and you write down the names of the candidates in their offices, but you have to spell everything right.
Right.
That's just a huge problem because there's a very limited amount of literacy. So that becomes pretty inconvenient. And then by the 1820s, which is when we think of universal manhood suffrage being realized, so all white men can vote, suddenly political parties, which have become newly strong with the rise of Andrew Jackson's Democratic Party, come up with this idea, well, actually, what if we just, we have plenty of printing presses now and we have partisan political newspapers. Why don't we just have our newspaper printers print ballots? They can put them in the newspaper. People can cut them out. And then we won't be losing all these votes. These votes would have to be thrown away because they were misspelled. And we'll have all kinds of ways of controlling the vote if we were to do this. And that happens at first. It's challenged on the grounds that it's unconstitutional to cast a printed ballot. But those printed ballots become more and more popular such that eventually printers are printing these long sheets that have the names of all the candidates and all their offices, that is, party strips. They don't list all the candidates on both sides or on from all different parties, just the candidates from one side. And those are called party tickets because they look like train tickets, you know, that list all the stops.
Which is why we call them tickets.
That's why we say you vote the party ticket.
Well, and those party tickets led to something called the Tasmanian Dodge. Someone would take two tickets, vote with one, and talk someone else into taking the spare. So ballots or tickets were eventually numbered to prevent that. We're hearing from Harvard historian Jill Lepore on the history of voting. Meanwhile, today, so far, there are just some problems reported at the polls, but at least no one is shooting at you. We'll have more with Jill after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. On this election day, we're revisiting our 2008 conversation about the history of voting in America with Harvard historian Jill Lepore. Before the break, she was talking about the birth of printed ballots, printed by parties, not the government, and some of the ways these tickets, which voters had to carry to polls, could be manipulated. For instance, party malcontents could print their own version of a ballot. That was called bolting. They could knife a candidate by stacking up a pile of party tickets and slicing his name out and then pasting a different name in. Now, there were actually pots of paste at polling places just for this purpose. So we asked Jill, when did it switch to governments taking over elections and printing the ballots?
It didn't switch until the 1880s, but the debate had been going on for quite a long time. In fact, Massachusetts is really crucial to this debate because in 1851, Massachusetts mandates an envelope law, which is to say the Secretary of State is actually going to provide uniform envelopes at every polling place so that if you could get there, if you were like a vest pocket voter, I love these guys, they try to shove their ballots in their vests so that they could get to the polls without anyone knowing how they were going to vote. If you could get there and then you could sneakily pull your ballot out and stuff it into an envelope. Then the Massachusetts legislature changes hands, and 2 years later, they repeal that law because there's such opposition to the idea that votes could be secret. I mean, there's a very strong argument to be made that a secret vote is a selfish vote, that to vote secretly is to be ashamed of your political opinions. And Massachusetts legislatures just refused to allow that law to stand, the envelope law. So even, and that's the, in the 1850s, it's a decade when Australia, where this reform finally succeeds in 1856, the Australian ballot law is passed, in which the idea that governments should print the ballots, they should print on those ballots all candidates for every office, and then voters would look at that piece of paper and make a decision and write or mark that piece of paper in some way and cast it in secret. But in the United States at that point, Massachusetts is repealing even an envelope law. So there's a tremendous resistance to the idea that voting should be secret in the United States.
I love some of the comments. You have the Virginian John Randolph insisting a secret ballot would make any nation a nation of scoundrels. I'm doing my math here, a couple hundred years, it's like the bedrock many people think of democracy, but it's so new.
It's very new. And in a way, not that it's not crucial and not that it's not an element of our political liberty that we ought to cherish, but it's really worth questioning because the arguments against it were actually quite powerful and eloquent and were then wholly put aside for the sake of adopting this reform, which, as you can imagine, people are dying at the polls. Something needs to be done. But it's not clear that it was entirely the right solution or that what was the right solution then is necessarily going to be the right solution forever.
Right. As you write, the whole system of elections in this country is really a system of patches, patches on patches on patches on patches. And we can't possibly be finished.
We're not finished. And it's not clear. I don't think it's clear that, and I tried to emphasize this in the piece, that a system of patches is necessarily bad.
Right.
Were, for instance, the founders to have written extensively about how we ought to vote, we might feel very constricted by those rulings.
And how did the advances in voting, if you want to see them that way, the ballots and the secrecy, how did that then disenfranchise blacks?
When you just go to a polling place and you bring a piece of paper that you have cut out of the newspaper, where a party symbol, an elephant or a donkey, that's where these party symbols come from. They date from this period. You can cast a ballot even if you're completely illiterate. The impetus for the reform and the reason it's so swiftly adopted, the Australian ballot reform in southern, the former Confederate states, is that it effectively disenfranchises freed slaves, most of whom don't know how to write. Teaching slaves to read was illegal in most Confederate states. So this first generation of black men who are voting in the United States generally just don't know how to read. And so to have to go to a polling place where you're handed a ballot that you need to read in order to cast a proper vote and that exercises your own political will is a way of disenfranchising black men. I mean, it's a de facto literacy test, but also southern states begin adopting actual literacy tests on the argument that if we're voting with these pieces of paper, we need to enforce literacy tests. Of course, then they only give the literacy tests to black men. Right. White men who are illiterate are just handed a ballot to cast. And then there are just much nastier reforms. Virginia, in one congressional election, prints a ballot with a Gothic lettering on it, this font that you and I couldn't possibly read.
You write, the year after Arkansas passed its Australian ballot law, the percentage of black men voting dropped from 71 to 38. That's stunning. But you also write that in 1896, 80% of Americans voted, 80%, and it's been dropping steadily since. Why do you think that is, by the way?
A lot of historians talk about what's been called the decline of popular politics, that the 19th century, for all the rowdiness of these elections, represented a very vigorous kind of democratic participation, where people went to the polls and debated and shouted at each other. It's not so great that they hit each other on the head and drew out guns, but they did actually vigorously debate the questions at hand. And there was a room for them in the culture to participate politically in this sort of rowdy way that, if you think about the kind of middle-class gentleman reformers at the late 19th century who find this whole thing rather unsavory and especially find these working-class men, rowdies at the in their cities voting, unpleasant, and they would like to have a much more gentleman, quiet and refined, and they're going to put everybody in these nice little cubbies, and it's going to be quiet, and you can't actually debate, and no one can bring banners or campaign. I mean, it is like going to an assembly line when you vote today. It's like running an errand to the post office. It is not like going to a town hall meeting. It's thrilling, but it's not thrilling in the same way, and it's not a vigorous debate in the same way. It's much more private. It's quiet. It's a little bit lonely. It doesn't necessarily make you feel like you are part of the public sphere.
You want more excitement and, you know, short of somebody bopping you over the head on the way there, a little more participation, dialogue.
I think debate. Election Day should be a public holiday. I think that would help turnout. I think a lot of people just can't make it to the polls. I think in the last few elections, people's experience at the polls have been miserable, well, but with the lines and all kinds of problems, it becomes an economic sacrifice for some people to vote.
That's Harvard historian Jill Lepore. We'll link you to her New Yorker article on voting in America at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, Jill's latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History, in which she says today's Tea Party is misreading history. We'll have Jill on down the road for her take on the Tea Party's success in this election. But meanwhile, tomorrow, Diane Reimer from Pennsylvania. If you're a Tea Partier, you've heard of her. She was an ordinary citizen who's now quit her job to become a full-time Tea Party activist. We'll get her view of Tea Party success and what happens now. That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, here and now.